Okay, welcome to the Bitcoin Gauntlet, episode 9. Today, I'm excited to have the host of Citadel Dispatch podcast, co-host of Rabbit Hole Recap podcast, managing partner at 1031, co-founder of OpenSats, the Bitcoin Policy Institute, and Bitcoin Park, Matt O'Dell. How are you doing today, Matt?
Cheers. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So I'll just give a quick intro of how the gauntlet works for you and for the audience. Matt will be presented with three topics, categories related to Bitcoin. Within that category, he'll see three debate prompts. He'll pick one, pick a side, and then we'll have a little bit of a discussion and back and forth about that debate prompt. So, Matt, are you ready for the Bitcoin gauntlet?
I'm as ready as I'm ever going to be.
All right. So round one, we have network slash consensus, mining, or regulation.
Let's pick network slash consensus.
Okay. Number one, BlackRock, Wall Street, etc. will attempt a hard fork. Number two, stablecoins on Lightning will corrupt mining and node incentives, which will lead to a contentious fork. Or three, Bitcoin is voluntary all the way down. Nodes don't have to broadcast all transactions, and miners don't have to include all transactions in blocks.
Let's go with one. BlackRock will attempt a hard fork.
Okay.
Do I pick which side I'm arguing? I think they will not attempt a hard fork. And do I defend my position?
Yeah, make your case for that position. Yeah.
I mean, look, I think the cool part about Bitcoin is that it's incredibly hard to change by default. I think a lot of people miss that fundamental. It is the bedrock that provides all the other value props of Bitcoin, because if you can change it very easily, then you can change it for the worse. All of a sudden changes become an attack vector. So one of the things, like the greater crypto ecosystem has, they either don't understand, or sometimes they understand it, but argue from a position of bad faith. As they say, Bitcoin is very slow to change. It doesn't update enough. It's old tech. We have all the latest and greatest innovations, blah, blah, blah. But really, it's the opposite. Like, that is what secures the 21 million cap. It's what secures censorship resistance. It's what secures permissionless access. It's this basic foundational layer that there's no company, no individual that can easily change Bitcoin. Now, at the flip side, what people miss with hard forks, particularly since we really only had one contentious hard fork in the history of Bitcoin, which was the 2017 Bcash hard fork, is that anyone can hard fork by design. That is actually also a key aspect of my conviction in Bitcoin, is that if for whatever reason, if there is significant momentum to hard fork Bitcoin or to change Bitcoin in a backwards compatible break, a non-backwards compatible breaking change, which is what a hard fork is, anyone can do it. Like, me and you can literally just hard fork Bitcoin tomorrow. Now, the hard part about that is you can actually technically hard fork, but the question is, does the economic majority actually follow you, or do they stay on whatever the existing chain is? Now, I think there's a decent possibility that we will have multiple hard forks in the future of Bitcoin. We need to do at least one to iron out some issues we have with the internal clock system, is my basic understanding. But that's a ways off. We can do it way ahead of time. Now, I actually think, and maybe this is a little bit off of the brief, but what I think might happen is we might see a hard fork that BlackRock does not support. And that could be interesting, where they are actually on the status quo side. And my main argument for that is I think the Bitcoin community is getting quite large and diverse. And for us to be able to agree on soft forks is becoming less and less likely. So for participants that want to see any kind of changes to Bitcoin, A hard fork is actually might be the more responsible path, because if you do a soft fork and you don't have consensus, you could end up with a chain split anyway that was not planned for. While if you do like a hard fork and you do like a 4 years out, you're like, we're going to hard fork in 4 years. It's a little bit more structured. Everyone has equivalent Bitcoin on each side. But anyway, all that said, there's a lot of context there. I think at the end of the day, BlackRock is a massive institution. They have a lot of moving pieces. They have tons of employees. And the risk of unilaterally trying to push forward some kind of hard fork is just fiduciary and irresponsibility. Like it's poor for their shareholders, it's poor for all their stakeholders. And they probably will be more resistant to change than most Bitcoin stakeholders out there right now. And if they do go along with a hard fork, it will be kind of just out of sheer momentum, and they'll do it kind of kicking and screaming. They'll do it after the fact.
Yeah, I've heard you mention this a couple times about hard forks over soft forks, and that was one of my old debate prompts as well. Now, if I were going to try and take the other side of this, I've referenced this a bunch of times on the show. Lynn Alden and Steve Lee put out a good piece last year talking about how Bitcoin consensus works and how there's multiple different parties. I think there's like six or so. You got the miners, the nodes, the software developers, the core developers, and the holders. And so we've seen tremendous uptake of this Bitcoin TM, trademark Bitcoin, that's corralled into these Wall Street derivative products. And I guess the concern is that given how fast that they've grown and how quickly they've grown, if they keep continuing to grow, then they can potentially get enough economic weight that they might either actively fork themselves or resist a fork by us, the self-custody holders. And they may have significant pull because of how much Bitcoin they have corralled in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two pieces here, right? Because first of all, technically speaking, having more Bitcoin does not give you more control over the network, which is also fundamental. I think that's what a lot of the proof of stake proponents miss, is they basically created, a new technical way of handling corporate shareholder voting. Like they just have shareholder voting mechanisms. This is how corporations have worked throughout history. You have, a shareholder table, they vote, and that's the way the corporation goes. Same thing with proof of stake. But, they have cryptographic elements there, to do it programmatically. But they basically just reinvented shareholder voting. The cool part about Bitcoin is if you're richer or you have more Bitcoin, doesn't necessarily give you direct influence over the network or the protocol. Now, in times of hard fork, or any kind of chain split. So, like, we could have a soft fork with a resulting chain split because there's not actually consensus. We've never actually had that, at least in modern Bitcoin history. We've never had some kind of contentious soft fork where their consensus was thought to be there, but it wasn't there after the fact and results in a chain split. But either way, whether it's an unintentional chain split or an intentional chain split through a hard fork, at that point, the previous history of the chain is duplicated. You can think about it like it's duplicated across two different assets and two different networks. And then going forward, they have different history. And what happens is they start getting traded against each other. And you start to see a market reaction to which side is more valuable. This is what we saw during Bitcoin Cash. At the same time, you see similar dynamics with hash rate, where if you're a Bitcoin miner, you can choose which chain you want to mine and which chain you want to secure. And both of those metrics are obviously instructive of where stakeholder demand is and which chain will likely dominate. The short term is like a little bit more noise. And then I think long term, what happens is one clearly wins and then the other one trends to zero, which is what we saw with Bitcoin Cash. It's what we saw with Bitcoin SV, Bitcoin Gold, all the other smaller ones. Now, but there's a key thing here is because. That's not a, first of all, that's not a vote. It's not a shareholder vote. And then second of all, once you use your ammo, you don't have any more Bitcoin or whatever the fork Bitcoin is. So it takes a lot of conviction to make that trade. And one of the cool things about hard forks for me is like during 2017, if you had conviction around Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash, like maybe you could have ended up with 20, 30, 40% more Bitcoin. But if you didn't have conviction, you could just sit it out and just wait and hold both sides and see what happens. And most participants did that. And so the question becomes, do the BlackRocks of the world, do the Coinbases of the world, do the Wall Streets of the world have the conviction to go after one side and take significant career and financial risk to do that by dumping one side for the other side? And meanwhile, if you look at individual holders, while we're not so big in number, in terms of amount of Bitcoin held, it's quite high. It's like 13 to 15 million coin or something like that. So I think like the random OG that has like 80,000 Bitcoin, he is way more likely to just go out there and just ape into one side and move the market in one direction or the other, compared to Larry Fink and his 10,000 employees and how they are going to handle that situation. I think they're going to be way more conservative. They're going to be having board meetings. They're going to be sitting around, kind of just w watching and seeing what's happening, while that kind of unfolds.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you said. I think they're not likely to do it, and even if they did, I'm very optimistic that they would fail. And most likely they'll have thought about this game theory in advance and just realize that they'd likely fail and not even do it. At the same time, I think some of these Wall Street people are pretty reckless. Their education and their incentives, turn them into, as Max Keiser would call, financial terrorists who are kind of trained to blow themselves up and they get rewarded for blowing themselves up. So I wouldn't put it past them just because maybe they're just being irrational. But yeah, ultimately I would agree that they're probably not going to do it, and even if they did, I think they would fail. So.
Awesome.
All right. Let's go to round two. We have Austrian Economics 1, Adoption, and Miscellaneous.
I love it's just a joker question with miscellaneous. Let's go with adoption.
Okay. Yeah, miscellaneous are things I just couldn't fit into other categories, so I put them in there. All right,
Wild
adoption.
card.
Yeah. All right, adoption. Number one, stablecoin adoption is a net negative for Bitcoin adoption in a given jurisdiction. Two, Bitcoin will be adopted more slowly than the internet. Or three, eventually adoption will accelerate and break diminishing returns.
I'm going to go with Bitcoin will be adopted more slowly than the internet. And I mean, I think it'll be adopted much faster than the internet because the internet exists.
Okay. Fair. Yeah, that's fair. Let's see. To steal man the other side, what about the weight of the monetary system and its size, its pull, its connection to all the governments, all their violence, all their institutions, that it's such a huge thing to move, to rewire this century, over a century of fiat propaganda, fiat education and economics in government, that it will move more slowly than just information. Like money is still information, but there's no real like tangible, discrete like value to it. Whereas information is just more vapid.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really, I was very young during the birth of the internet. But if you look back on like tapes and stuff, and like Paul Krugman's famous call of like it's nothing more than a bit, small innovation over a fax machine, and they have like the CBS clips of like the host being completely confused about email and at signs and stuff. I think there was a pretty big hurdle, at least kind of in a paradigm shift way with the internet. And we're kind of seeing a lot of similarities there with Bitcoin. I think specifically the one difference being that with the internet, it didn't really have like any kind of real direct competitors. I think with Bitcoin, it's quite obvious that traditional financial rails compete with it. Things like Venmo in the West compete with it. Obviously the banking system and everything else competes with it. And people are probably slower to take risk with money versus like a new way to send a message, right? Like the stakes are higher. Like if you're talking about the financial security and safety of your family or your businesses, I think you're going to take that a lot more seriously than sending someone a message. So I think the hurdle for Bitcoin in the beginning is probably much higher. But once that like it starts rolling down the hill and that boulder starts gaining speed, the internet has a tendency to make phenomenons viral quicker than anyone could expect them. This is a trend that we've seen throughout modern internet history. The big one I always like to highlight is, the Arab Spring, which is just a bunch of governments just getting taken down basically by tweets. So I think that viral nature, that interconnectedness of everything, coupled with the fact that there's cracks all throughout the institutions our society relies on, and the financial system is in a pretty weak and vulnerable point right now that has only been trending worse. As people start to wake up to it, I think people are undercounting that viral phenomenon. And I in terms of adoption for Bitcoin, I think it probably looks like an S curve. I think people think we're further along on the S curve than we are right now. Like I think there's going to be dramatic upswings still ahead of us.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up with the basically the third prompt. Like, do you subscribe to the gradually then suddenly model, or do you subscribe to like a power law model, diminishing returns type of model? As far as adoption, not necessarily the number, the fiat number.
I think it's I think diminishing returns happens under the gradually then suddenly model as well. I think I prescribe more to it's like gradually then suddenly then gradually then suddenly more. That's kind of my thesis. It happens in cycles, right? We've seen it happen in cycles, adoption happen in cycles. But it makes sense to me that as adoption increases, Bitcoin volatility in general and the returns you might see over certain periods of time should reduce. And it should basically eventually become the most stable money in the world. And effectively, the volatility you see is like the volatility in society. If there's a world war or something, then it will be volatile. If there's good times and GDP is increasing and humanity is being more productive than ever, then it will slowly increase in purchasing power. But over time, barring, the like as long as humanity is flourishing, like Bitcoin should increase in value over time, and then those returns should diminish as adoption increases.
Yeah, eventually we get to the point where the purchasing power appreciation attracts global GDP. And Parker Lewis recently was talking about he thinks everyone will be using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange within 10 years. I'm pretty bullish, but that's pretty bullish even for me. Personally, I think that the inflection point when we really take off is when the market cap of Bitcoin reaches parity with the US Treasury market. And that's not my idea. I got that from Saifedean. Just because it's the most liquid good and it's used as the like monetary settlement tool, basically, the US Treasury market. So once it
What
has
is that
this,
market cap?
it's about 30 trillion.
Okay. So
So,
that's it's like a 12x.
or maybe a little bit more, oh, maybe like
Like 50,
35, or
oh,
yeah, something like
it's like a
that.
15x then.
Yeah, easy.
Right, we're like 2 trillion.
Yeah, easy. So once that liquidity flywheel gets going, I think that's when we're really off to the races. And that might be sooner than people think. And I think that's a good benchmark for if you're thinking about this gradually then suddenly model.
It's an interesting thought process, right? Because what gold's market cap is 13 trillion, I think, or at least the gold that we know about.
I thought it's more now because it's gone up so much, maybe 20 or
I don't know, but that's
something in that
interesting.
range, yeah.
It's interesting because let's ask the AI. Because you can think of that as like kind of the store of value threshold, and then treasuries as kind of the ultimate reserve monetary asset. And I do prescribe to like, store of value, unit of account, medium of exchange. The real question is how long that takes. I would agree that 10 years is probably pretty bullish, at least in the West. But also like a lot of it doesn't even come down to Bitcoin, right? A lot of it just comes down to macro. I think Safe once said that the biggest threat to Bitcoin is, governments responsibly handling their finances, which is true. Very unlikely that they do, particularly since they've dug themselves such a big hole, specifically in America. But that remains to be the case. So if they do, and I know like a lot of people like in the early days of this administration were like, oh, they got Doge, they're going to cut costs, do all this stuff, and there was a lot of people in denial. And now it's become obvious like that was all pretty much a show and negligible change happened.
Yeah, nothing stops this train.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think on the gold versus treasuries piece, I think most of the gold market cap, in my opinion, is on speculation about its remonetization and use as a settlement vehicle, which is what treasuries are for.
Fair enough.
So, even as far as a store value, I guess, but as far as being like the most liquid good being moved around and settled, it's treasuries, and gold is more of a speculative asset.
Yeah, I guess they're all kind of competing for the same. Bitcoin, gold, treasuries, kind of competing for the same thing.
Okay,
Okay,
any
so total value, by the way, just for the listeners, is approximately 24 trillion in gold.
okay. Yeah, it's gone up
So
a
you were
lot, so.
right. Yeah.
All right,
Not a
any
stat I really track.
Yeah. Anything else to say on that one?
Nope.
All right.
Gradually, then suddenly.
Nice. All right, round three. We have Austrian economics 2, political philosophy, and Bitcoin culture.
Let's do political philosophy.
All right. Number one, on a Bitcoin standard, monarchy is preferable to democracy. Number two, strategic reserves are immoral because everything the state has is stolen. And three, Bitcoin is not democratic, and that's okay.
I'll go with one. On a Bitcoin standard, monarchy is preferable to democracy. And I'm going to argue against that. I think on a Bitcoin standard, smaller government is preferable to larger government, and more local government is preferred to, government that's farther away from you and larger in scope. And I think probably when you're looking at the local level, one of the beauties of the local level is, first of all, it's more lean, it's more accountable to the residents, it's more efficient, it has less opportunity to be corrupt because of that accountability. And I think that probably looks more like a direct democracy than a monarchy. Probably not perfect, right? Like, I think, like, if you're in a small town of 5,000 people or something like that, there is some kind of leader that's in charge. But I don't think he's like passing down his leadership to his children. I think there's gonna be a lot of overturn there. I think in general, if you empower the individual, humanity flourishes. And if you think about a situation where the individual is empowered, it actually kind of goes against these large representative democracies and large monarchies. It kind of goes against both, because it brings the power down lower. So yeah, I think the age of incredibly large constitutional republics or democracies or whatever you want to call it is fading, but I also think the era of large monarchies is fading, and under a Bitcoin standard, the era of the individual, the family, and the small community is rising.
True. Yeah, I definitely agree that because of Bitcoin, it empowers the individual and reduces the amount of theft that happens overall, and the state is the biggest thief. So definitely agree that it's gonna overall shrink the size of the states in terms of how much resources they have, but also their geographic jurisdiction as well. So maybe the thing we could talk about more is all else being equal. Same geographic area, same amount of population, which one would be more preferable? And so on the monarchy side, you could say that and Hoppe and Seyfeddin, Prince Hans Adam have talked about this, that the time preference of the monarch is much longer than a elected official, even in a small area. Say a few thousand people, because the elected official has a turnover and they're incentivized to plunder as much as possible because they won't get as much of an opportunity to do that in the future. It's funny, I was actually listening to a lecture from Hoppe from 1994 about this morning, so it's fresh. And so there's that, no solutions, only trade-offs. So which one, the high time preference, a low time preference, assuming that same geographic area, same amount of these places too. Like if you look at an old map of Europe with all these tiny, tiny polities of monarchs, and especially with Bitcoin as your primary form of capital, as opposed to say houses and equities and bonds and fiat, which are all presumably either gone or extremely demonetized, your capital is more mobile and you're more able to move between these polities, if one is becoming reckless. So, yeah,
Well,
got
my
those
argument,
trade-offs.
I tend to agree with your framing, with the caveat that if the goal of the individual is to be empowered and to control their own life and their own path, I kind of actually look at it from a perspective of threat modeling. And so, yes, the sovereign individual has greater movement. But what is the biggest threat to that movement? What can turn over their life tomorrow? And that is actually probably more likely to be a monarchy, because they're more adaptable. They can move very quickly. This actually gives monarchies probably an advantage in a Bitcoin standard from the government level, in terms of if you look at who's the first movers. It's like the Bhutans of the world. Because they don't need to have like a board meeting and get senators involved and stuff. They can just stack Bitcoin quietly. But if you look at it from the sovereign individual perspective, you could be raising your family, everything could be going great. Who's more likely to throw you in a cage and destroy your life tomorrow if you get on the wrong side of them? It's probably the monarch. It's probably the person who has unilateral control, or whose small group of people have unilateral control, while the actual negatives from like a government efficiency point of view of a bureaucratic democracy kind of defangs them in a way. Like they have to move slower. They're not as effective as at quickly taking away freedoms. They're very effective at slowly taking away freedoms. But if you have the movement of a sovereign individual, you can counteract that much easier than the secret police just coming in and throwing you in the gulag.
True. All I see here are trade-offs. So,
All the way down.
that's my favorite phrase. I say it every day. All, no solutions, only trade-offs. So, in the monarchy example, if you have, say, 5,000 people, to your point number earlier, if you have one monarch and 4,999, there's just more people. So if the monarch is doing something really reckless, he's susceptible to being just thrown out because there's so many people on the other side that he can't deal with them all. The people can leave, his power shrinks, his, whatever remaining tax revenue, which is probably from real estate, shrinks. And then on the other side, with a democracy, it's just the tyranny of the majority. So if you're on the wrong side of you're in an extreme minority, then you can just be overtaken by, your vote almost doesn't really matter if you're in the minority. And we saw that a lot during COVID, restriction of freedoms. At one point, I think something like 60% of Democrats wanted to put the unvaccinated in camps towards the peak of the hysteria, and that's what you get with democratic rules. You get the rule by the mob, the tyranny of the majority too. So, both sides. I mean, I guess if you're in a tyrannical
That's
democracy as
true.
well, you could leave. So at least with Bitcoin, you have the ability to exit and move your
Yeah, I mean,
capital.
on that
So.
thought process, I would say, like maybe the preferable path is to constantly hop between democracies where you're in the tyrannical majority.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. Or who knows, maybe some kind of constitutional monarchy or something like that.
Yeah, somewhere in between. There could be something in between. In general, I would say though that where I would like to see my family located in, let's say, 15, 20 years, is somewhere where there's strong property rights and as small local government as possible.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of this, which makes me very optimistic, is that if we can agree that ultimately Bitcoin will shrink the size of these polities and their power, that means that they'll be more numerous, which to
Yep.
me sounds like competition, free market competition and innovation, and in all likelihood there'll be some kinds of government structures that we just simply can't even imagine today because it's too far out. We don't really have the skin in the game, and they'll be able to compete on a pretty mostly free market. So that makes me very optimistic about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and the key there too is where a lot of my theories fall apart, because I think the steel man argument against that is, well, there's going to be a lot of people that are just not capable of moving and taking advantage of that competition. And I would just say, I'm just describing what I expect to happen. I'm not saying necessarily it is the most ideal situation. And what you need to do is make yourself in a position that you are able to move easily, and that you do it frequently, and you're able to adapt on the fly. That will be a superpower. It's the people that either dig their feet in denial, or weren't able to build up the financial security and the capability to actually move with their feet, that will probably feel the most pain. And that is something we saw very clearly during COVID.
Yeah, I think during the transition period, that'll definitely be the case, and I'm hopeful that once Bitcoin is fully monetized and demonetized everything else, that'll make things a little bit easier, especially by demonetizing real estate. Most people in the West, especially America, basically their entire life savings is their house, and there's a lot of friction associated with selling your house, a lot of fees, all kinds of problems, and that makes it very difficult to move relatively. Whereas if you just have your Bitcoin, you can just get on a plane and go. So,
Agree.
all right. So we have our final round here. Protocol changes, psychology, and miscellaneous again.
Let's go with miscellaneous.
All right.
Wild card.
Okay. Number one, courage is more important than intelligence for understanding Bitcoin. Number two, newly minted Bitcoiners are actually too early, not too late, And number three, countries that attempt CBDCs will hyper-Bitcoinize faster than those that don't. If you need me to explain number two, I can. Sometimes it's a little confusing for people.
Well, why don't you explain it? I think I know what you mean.
So I stole this from Max Keiser. One time he told this story. He saw a young child in El Salvador, and he was thinking about how all the benefits that that child is going to experience from a world that's Bitcoinized versus Max, who's a little bit older. I mean, he's seen obviously tremendous purchasing power appreciation in his life, but that even though the child won't have been able to buy Bitcoin for whatever, a penny, that they'll see a better improvement in their life from Bitcoin's full adoption than Max has seen from his price appreciation.
That's fascinating. I think I prescribe to that theory. I want to do though. I want to do. Countries that attempt CBDCs will hyper Bitcoinize faster than those that don't. And I want to take. That's such an interesting one. It's a good one because I'm not positive on which side I fall. I think I will take that they will hyper Bitcoinize faster than those that don't. I'll argue in the affirmative. Look, I think to go what we were saying earlier, I mean, look, I've done a lot of work with the Human Rights Foundation training activists, people on the ground in Nigeria, Bolivia, Venezuela. We met with Argentinians that weren't necessarily activists, but we were training them on the ground on how to escape inflation. And where there's a need, Zimbabweans, Serbians, and where there's a need for better money, it's like the easiest. You're not selling them on Bitcoin. They already know they need Bitcoin. They don't know how to use it. All they want to know is which apps do I install? How do I use the thing? And I will use it. I was talking to a Serbian activist the other day, and before we improved his Bitcoin skills, like the way he was getting money in and out of country was they were strapping tens of thousands of dollars around there in cash around their legs and going through security. And if you got caught, your life was ruined. And if you didn't get caught, you only got like $10,000 across the border. You can send that in a text message with Bitcoin. CBDCs don't solve that for them. It makes it actually worse in a lot of ways because of the tracking and control elements. Cash doesn't solve that for them. Gold doesn't solve that for them, but Bitcoin does. So I think as the noose gets tightened in the West specifically, and we start to see more of the pain points there, it starts looking like developing world adoption, where it's the need for Bitcoin is obvious, the need for better money is obvious. How do I use it? How do I get a hold of it? And now the one caveat I would say is probably in the short term, it slows down Bitcoin adoption because they probably won't be as dystopian in the beginning. And we're seeing a lot of the stablecoin stuff. We just saw the Genius Act pass in America. Like the stablecoins have a lot of similarities to, I hate that they're called stablecoins. USD tokens have a lot of similarity to CBDCs, except they're not run by the central bank. So I like calling them PBDCs, they're private bank digital currencies. But right now, they actually offer you a decent amount of freedom when you use them. The surveillance is there, but and seizures happen, but it's just not really happening that often. So I think in the beginning, it actually becomes a very useful tool that doesn't have the volatility and the paradigm shifting nature of adopting Bitcoin as a money, this like free market, like truly uncontrollable money, which requires a little bit more courage or effort to actually adopt than just like a USD token. But humans can't control themselves. And so as like humans in power can't control themselves. So like as these things roll out, they're going to get more and more dystopian, and then you kind of rolls into the gradually then suddenly Bitcoin thing, and those countries that go cashless, that go more CBDC or PBDC, will end up hyper Bitcoinizing faster because they'll basically be the advertising model for Bitcoin.
Yeah, there's a lot of different feedback loops here of incentives, and maybe it also depends on which countries we're talking about. You know, are we talking about Zimbabwe, or are we talking about United States? And the type of culture, maybe Japan as another wild card. I ultimately think, whether or not different jurisdictions will try CBDCs or what they look like, if they're explicitly from the central bank or these private currencies, we don't know. But if I were going to argue the other side, say in the West, the amount of compliance I think we see, and certainly what we saw, the amount of compliance we saw in COVID was pretty high. So as fiat continues, the most of the population becomes more and more desperate. And these CBDCs have this element of control, and they can be used for behavioral control too. Like, imagine we went through COVID with these things. All like, where what you can buy, all the litany of dystopian things associated with the behavioral control. And I think just in general, the compliance on these things will be super high in the West. And so I think
Yeah,
that'll
I mean, if
slow down Bitcoin.
oh, it'll slow down Bitcoin
It'll
because
slow
people
down
will just
Bitcoin adoption.
comply.
I think they'll just comply. They'll be so desperate and
But what
comply.
do
I
you
mean,
do? I so I also think it slows down Bitcoin adoption in the beginning, but I think it
yeah.
ultimately accelerates Bitcoin adoption. Would you agree with that thesis, or do you think it just generally slows down Bitcoin adoption?
True, yeah. I mean, we'd really have to start talking about time scales, I guess. It depends. I mean, then
And
you get
my
into
time scale is like slowing down. It slows down Bitcoin adoption in the next 5 or so years, but in the next 10 to 20, it accelerates Bitcoin adoption. And I'll give you an example. If COVID happened with a CBDC, which it kind of did a little bit. I mean, New York was using like IBM blockchain for their like digital COVID passports. The craziness kind of subsided a little bit before they like fully rolled it out. They were close. But like, let's just say they were using payments as a way to enforce lockdowns. So instead of having police on the street, they just tracked every time you went to the store. And if you went to the store more than 3 times during a lockdown period, which is something we kind of saw in China happening, then you faced fines or jail time or some kind of repercussions. Maybe your social credit score gets impacted. In that environment, I feel like it'd be a lot easier for me to sell Bitcoin to my fellow American than the current like frog boiling environment where like the money like works pretty well. They're like not really tightening the noose. They're not, outwardly showing the dystopian tendencies. It's kind of happening behind the surface. They're like picking and choosing a couple people to make targets of.
true. That's one side of the behavioral control, which is punishment. But then you also might have reward too. So for good behavior, good comrade behavior, you get paid. And
Fair
so,
enough. Yeah, that's pretty fucked up. I mean, I think probably we're probably going to see UBI come. Look, I think the one lesson I did learn is from COVID specifically. I have this tweet. Now my Twitter's deleted. So the worst part about deleting my Twitter is all the past tweets that are gone with it. But there was a tweet in like December 2019. So like 3 months before lockdowns, like what everyone freaked out like March 2020. So like 4 months before lockdowns. And the tweet was bullish on humanity. And I sometimes think like I just jinxed the entire world by sending that tweet out. I think the reality I've come to is that the overwhelming majority of people are going to take like, regardless of where we are in the world, I don't even think it comes down to a country by country basis. Maybe the percentages slightly change. We'll take like the compliance status quo easy path. They won't take the path of personal responsibility. And so when we're talking about hyper Bitcoinization or Bitcoinization or whatever, I think even in that situation where like Bitcoin is used as the reserve currency of the world, 95% of people are going to be using it in a surveilled, non-freedom oriented way, where Bitcoin itself is almost like a CBDC, with the benefit that you can't inflate it, right? You can't debase it. So you we get that benefit. But in terms of using it as true freedom money, spending and saving it out with permission, the overwhelming majority of people will not go down that path. So when I think about this prompt, I'm thinking about, would CBDCs increase that intolerant minority of freedom money enjoyers, that 5%? Will it make it more likely that it's 7% or 8% versus 3% or 2%? And I think yes.
Yeah, I think ultimately I agree. And going back to something you mentioned earlier about safety and saying the biggest risk to Bitcoin would be fiscal responsibility, that the more tax we see on personal freedom and on savings, the more the Bitcoin will be adopted. So, if we could just trust each other, trust each other and just live on 100% gold backing, then yeah, we wouldn't need Bitcoin. But that's not how the incentives work. That's not how human nature works. So I think yeah,
I mean,
we'll continue to be attacked, and that will just drive ever more Bitcoin adoption. So I do really agree. Yeah.
to combine those two last points, the one I made and the one you made, probably the most likely way for governments to practice fiscal responsibility is to adopt a Bitcoin standard, but the Bitcoin standard being the cucked, non-freedom oriented standard. So then they don't even have to trust themselves and trust their organizations. They can't debase by design. But the overwhelming majority of people are using it, through KYC exchanges, custodial situations. They're not practicing self-custody. They're not using the tools and learning about the different trade-offs of using Bitcoin privately and spending it on a day-to-day basis in a private way. That probably reduces the usage of Bitcoin as freedom money the most, is the quicker a country adopts Bitcoin in a controlled way and captures it. And I think that's what we're seeing happening now in the US, with the added advantage that Wall Street and whatnot do have a strong incentive to do this from a financial point of view. They stand to make a lot of money. And this is something that I've expected and talked about for years. This expectation, and it's unfortunately seems to be what we're watching happen.
Yeah, there's a good, or I don't know if I'll say good, but a relevant article by Ben Hunt from maybe 4 years ago. He talks about this coin, the phrase Bitcoin TM, trademark Bitcoin, and basically exactly what you said, that this corralled Bitcoin into Wall Street is a big threat, especially from a privacy standpoint. So.
Yeah, I mean, where I disagree with Ben is, he used that as an argument to not adopt Bitcoin and not improve his skills on Bitcoin. While I think, in a lot of ways, people who choose personal responsibility and individual freedom and use Bitcoin as freedom money benefit from a lot of this stuff. It's just the masses don't. Our purchasing power increases. The chances of us getting to the sent to the gulags decreases. Just the amount of capital in general that's available to people building out the Bitcoin ecosystem is just way, way, way higher. So if you go net, 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 like, would I prefer to raise my family in an administration like the last one we had that was super hostile towards Bitcoiners, throwing Bitcoiners in jail? Or would I prefer to do it under administration that is clearly capturing Bitcoin and trying to bring it in controlled, surveilled walled gardens? Probably the second is the preferable one. But as we've said many times on the show, trade-offs all the way down.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so that concludes round four. And here I have one bonus question. And
Bonus
I have I
round.
know you how much you like hats, and on my hat here, the bonus question is, where does the yield come from? From our friend Alan Farrington, of course, from back in 2021 with all the degenerate yield farming.
Nailed
So,
it.
bonus points for funny answers, insightful answers, novel answers I haven't heard before, for where does the yield come from?
Well, it depends what the question is. Is the question I mean, I think a lot of these yield schemes, like the yield comes from a greater fool, is like the core is the core of it. I think that a more interesting question is, in a post-Bitcoin world, where does the yield come from? And where does the re quote unquote responsible yield, which might be a provocative statement, come from? And I think that's from positive sats flowing businesses, like producing value for the world, like just classic value investing. And I think once real estate's demonetized, like you will get sats flow from real estate again. That makes sense, but like it needs to go through like a massive, tumultuous, chaotic transition period where Bitcoin completely remonetizes it and takes out a ton of value out of it. But at some point in like 30 years or whatever, you'll be able to buy like a mixed use building with a retail store in it and some apartments on top, and everything will be denominated in Bitcoin, and they will pay you Bitcoin rent. And the diminishing returns of Bitcoin's purchasing power means that parking your Bitcoin in that building will get you more sats flow over time or whatever. You'll do some kind of discounted sats flow math. I think that's a thing. And then the other thing that's kind of interesting, that's probably more in the nearest term, is like one-to-one insurance pools for Bitcoin denominated in Bitcoin that pay out really low yield, like that pay out like sub 1% or maybe a little bit higher than that, to basically put your Bitcoin in some kind of an insurance pool. That's probably it's a little bit too early for that now, but I think there's ways you can do that in a probably in a more responsible way. And what we've seen in the past has been, it's mostly just like hidden risk and degeneracy and greater fool theory that fuels all the yield type of schemes.
Yeah, I definitely subscribe to Saifedean's interpretation of this, that in the future there'll be more equity investing instead of debt investing. I know him and Saylor had a really hot debate about that last year. Really good if anybody hasn't seen that. So that the total amount of debt in the system will decrease dramatically in favor of equity. And I think we'll probably see PE ratios come way, way down from the farcical levels that they're at right now, like totally blown out, ridiculous, overly monetized, on the back of insane amounts of leverage, which is debt. And to Saifedean's point again, as we get more and more civilized, our capital structures get deeper and deeper. Long-term interest rates come down over time; they trend downwards. So, I think that's even more incentive for equity-based investment and quote unquote yield, positive sats flow than counterparty risk and debt. So
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought that Safe Sailor was one of the better podcasts in a while in the Bitcoin space.
yeah, it was real heavyweight match. I mean,
That was a good
it was
one.
like I was watching a UFC fight or something. It was
And
pretty
yeah,
intense.
I mean, sit like Sailor usually gets the benefit of softballs, and Safe doesn't like playing the softball game. So that's why we all love him.
Yeah. All right, well, Matt, you've survived the Bitcoin gauntlet,
Nice.
and I will vibe code you a score in real time here, and I'm going to give you a score of 21 mandibles.
Wow. That sounds like a perfect score.
Out of how many mandibles, we have no idea, but 21 mandibles seems like an appropriate score for Matt. So
Did you have a mandibles prompt in here somewhere that I missed?
no,
They're all kind of mandibles prompts.
what would be a good mandibles prompt?
Does Bitcoin make mandibles less likely or less severe?
Does Marty read mandibles before or after 200K?
He's never gonna read man the after.
After, okay.
It's a false question because he's just never gonna read it. It's really funny. I did have a friend finally read Mandibles and just like texted me panicking about his job getting replaced by AI. And I was like, okay, maybe it's like not the best for some people. For me, it was like the fact that we have Bitcoin and that we have the Freedom Tech tools and that we have the strong communities we're building up. To me, it was like less of a depressing read. But I could see if you don't have that hope element, if you don't realize there's like a better way, and that this book basically focuses on a failed micro society, which is like the New York Northeast area. It can get really, really depressing. So I'm optimistic. I'm not a doomer. I'm banking on human flourishing.
I could definitely see that if you didn't understand Bitcoin, nihilism would be a pretty
Exactly.
rational interpretation. And I certainly was that way myself. And then discovering Bitcoin has made everything just a lot better, a lot more optimistic. So freedom tech all the way makes things better.
Love it. Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. I hope you had fun. And thanks for your time.
Cheers.